25 years later. Ordinary Men was first published in 1992, following the publication of Daniel Goldhagen's Hitler's Willing Executioners in 1996, and the ensuing debate over our differing interpretational approaches and methodologies concerning the use of problematic evidence. A second edition of Ordinary Men was published in 1998, with an afterword that summarized my arguments in this controversy. Now, 25 years after its first publication, it seems fitting to take stock once again. I will examine four areas in which fruitful historical research has added to our knowledge and insight about the issues raised by the initial publication of Ordinary Men. First, there have been numerous studies of other battalions of the Order Police, which allows for a much fuller comparative context of the ways in which Reserve Police Battalion 101 was typical or representative, and the ways in which its singularity was illuminating. Second, there have been further contributions to the study of the motivation of ordinary participants in the Final Solution. Third, there has been an exemplary study of the contingent of Luxembourg police in the battalion that allows for a comparison of the German and non-German members of the unit. And fourth, there has been a more careful study of photographic evidence, both old and new, concerning RPB 101. Other battalions of the Order Police. In chapters 3 and 4 of Ordinary Men, I made brief mention of the role of police battalions 309 and 322 in Bialystok, Reserve Police Battalion 45 in the Ukraine, Police Battalion 11 in Slutsk, and Reserve Police Battalion 133 in Eastern Galicia. Daniel Goldhagen also discussed Police Battalions 309 in Bialystok and 65 in the Baltic in 1941 and Southern Poland in 1942. Beginning in the 1990s, further studies of some of these units, as well as many others, finally began to be published. First was the journalist Heiner Lichtenstein's Himmler's Grüne Helfer, Die Schutz- und Ordnungspolizei im Dritten Reich, that reviewed the judicial investigations of various order police units, especially battalions, and the failure of the German courts to achieve anything but a handful of convictions. This was quickly followed by two different studies of Police Battalion 322 that were based upon the rare surviving war diaries of the battalion and its third company that were among a collection of SS documents held in the military archive in Prague. This battalion began its murderous activities in Bialystok in July 1941, and then moved across present-day Belarus, engaging in major killing actions in Minsk and Mogilev, as well as many other smaller mass killings. In 1996, Winfried Nachtwey looked at five different police battalions that were primarily recruited from Rhineland cities. In addition to the two battalions touched upon by Goldhagen, namely 65 and 309, he also examined 307 and 316, like 322, members of the police regiment under the command of Colonel Mantua during the July 1941 killings in Bialystok. And finally, Reserve Police Battalion 61, notorious for its role in guarding the Warsaw Ghetto. Richard Breitman, in his book Official Secrets, briefly touched on Police Battalions 322 and 11, as well as Police Regiment South, comprised of 45, 303, and 314. These rather cursory sketches were followed by two particularly important studies. In 1998, Edward Westerman published his study of Police Battalion 310, in which he focused on the striking dissimilarities between that unit and Reserve Police Battalion 101. Police Battalion 310 spent 16 months in Poland, October 1941 to February 1942, learning to behave like an occupying master race before being transferred to Soviet territory and suffering heavy casualties on the Leningrad front. Its rank and file, mostly born between 1905 and 1912, were drawn from a much more Nazified age cohort. Over 40% held party membership and some 10% SS membership. At the core of Westerman's study is his account, based on both surviving reports and judicial interrogations, of the battalion's pacification actions from August through October 1942, in which the battalion engaged in the casual equal opportunity killing of Jews, Slavs, Ostmenschen, Gypsies, and various categories of asocials, in short, the entire spectrum of National Socialism's ideologically targeted enemies. Arguing that the historian can infer motivation from the words, deeds, party membership, age cohort, and experiences of indoctrination and brutalization of the men of Police Battalion 310, Westerman concludes that they should be thought of as ideological soldiers, rather than ordinary men. Just 1 year later, 1999, Klaus Michael Malmen published a study of Police Battalion 307 from Lübeck. Following 9 months of occupation duty in Poland, it was involved in the mass killing of adult male Jews in Brest-Litovsk in July 1941, and then in subsequent killings in Belarus. Ghetto clearing in the Lublin district in the spring and summer of 1942 was then followed by anti-partisan campaigns in Belarus from fall 1942 to summer 1944. In the initial massacre at Brest-Litovsk, Malmen noted, all the shooters were drawn from an ample supply of volunteers. He dismissed coercion, brutalization, and propaganda as adequate explanations, employing, like Goldhagen, the notion of a cognitive model through which the policemen viewed and understood their world. Malmen invoked what he called a situational radicalization of the image of the enemy. The biological, political, ideological, and now real enemy were blended into a virtual reality that legitimized killing Jews as necessary self-defense. A prior anti-Semitic attitude, combined with the situational inversion of the German offense into perceived self-defense, drove the qualitative leap to mass murder. Two books that appeared in 2000 and 2001, each containing a series of articles by various authors on various order police units, returned the focus to the failure of the German judicial system even to bring to trial, much less convict, more than a handful of Holocaust perpetrators who wore the green uniform. Most important in expanding scholarly knowledge of the role of the order police in the Holocaust were two articles by Stefan Klemp that dealt with two battalions that were dispersed across the Eastern Front. Four companies of Police Battalion 9 were assigned one each to the four Einsatzgruppen. In this case, 247 members of this battalion were delivered by the British to Soviet authorities in January 1947. They typically received 25-year sentences, but were released in 1956. Klemp also studied Reserve Police Battalion 69, which was divided into small detachments that were distributed across the Eastern Front in August 1941 for the purpose of guarding construction work sites of Organization Todt, but were also frequently employed to kill nearby Jews. After this spate of articles on different police battalions, most of which focused on establishing the facts of their killing activities during the war and near total lack of judicial consequence after the war, five books have been more recently published that merit special mention. In 2005, Harald Welzer published Täter, wie aus ganz normalen Menschen Massenmörder werden, a social-psychological study of how ordinary men become mass murderers, that used the judicial interrogations of Reserve Police Battalion 45 as its empirical basis. In the same year, Edward Westerman published Hitler's Police Battalions, Enforcing Racial War in the East, which examined the organizational culture of the German order police and how this was reflected in its members' subsequent behavior in Eastern Europe. In 2011, Carl Schneider published Auswärts eingeschätzt, Bremer Polizeibataillone und der Holocaust, a dense study of the two police battalions, 105 and 303 from the city of Bremen. And finally, Wolfgang Kurilla published two massive compendia that contained entries on all of the order police units stationed in the Baltic states and Belarus on the one hand, and in Poland on the other, and their respective contributions to the Holocaust. I will return to the Welzer and Westerman books later for their contribution to the debate over motivation, and will focus now on the work of Schneider and Kurilla for what they add to the comparative framework concerning RPB 101. Carl Schneider's careful reconstruction of the formation of both Reserve Police Battalion 105 and Police Battalion 303 shows how both were significantly different from RPB 101. What was initially designated Police Battalion 105 was formed in the fall of 1939. Its rank and file were drawn from the 1902 to 1909 cohorts, i.e. 30 to 37-year-olds, who had already served as reserve policemen in the 1937 to 1939 period. Roughly two-thirds of the rank and file were working class, one-third middle or lower middle class. Having already been at least partially indoctrinated and socialized into the German police during weekend training sessions in the pre-war period as reservists waiting to be mobilized, they received extensive military training and some additional ideological schooling in late 1939 and early 1940 before taking up rather pleasant and fondly remembered occupation duty in Norway and being renamed a Reserve Police Battalion in January 1941. The battalion then went on to serve in the Baltic in summer-fall 1941, where it conducted numerous anti-partisan operations, and in the Netherlands from 1942 to 1944, where it helped send transports of Dutch Jews to Auschwitz. After the outbreak of war, the rank and file of Police Battalion 303 was drawn from a pool of volunteers from the 1909 to 1912 cohorts, i.e. 27 to 30-year-olds, made available to the SS and police in exchange for the large numbers of trained policemen who had been transferred to the army. As Westermann has pointed out, this was a highly Nazified age group, and both the SS and police could exercise selectivity concerning whom among the oversupply of volunteers they chose. They received extensive training and were then sent for 9 months of occupation duty in Poland before invading the Ukraine in June 1941, where they participated in numerous massacres of Jews, including Babi Yar. Reserve Police Battalion 101, during its first and second tours of duty in Poland in 1939 and 1940, was constructed much the same way as RPB 105 or other murderous reserve battalions on Soviet territory in 1941, such as RPB 45 in the Ukraine and 133 in East Galicia. But after RPB 101 returned to Hamburg in 1941, its first generation of now highly experienced reserve policemen were reassigned, and the rank and file were reconstituted from cohorts in which the maximum age was pushed back to 45, i.e. born as early as 1896, and the average age shifted from the low 30s to nearly 40 years old. There was no luxury of selectivity. Schneider quotes the Bremen police president concerning the manpower shortage as the war progressed, stating that the city was fully pumped out. Hamburg was no different, and at this stage, training and indoctrination also became much more perfunctory. In short, those who wish to explain the murderous record of police battalions as a product of highly Nazified age cohorts, selectivity in recruiting, intense training and indoctrination, and the corrupting influence of months of imposing Nazi racial policy in Poland prior to service on Soviet territory, all factors that correlate with most police battalions, must confront the fact that these factors were absent for RPB 101. And thus are neither necessary nor sufficient factors in explaining its killing record. How did the killing record of RPB 101 compare with other battalions? The exhaustive studies of Wolfgang Kurilla now permit us to construct a chart that ranks the battalion's killing records. The top 12 were the following. RPB 61, 1,100 killed, 300,000 deported to death camps. RPB 9, 187,600 killed. RPB 133, 31,900 killed, 74,000 deported. RPB 101, 38,000 killed, 45,200 deported. RPB 53, 13,200 killed, 65,000 deported. PB 320, 66,700 killed. RPB 45, 65,000 killed. RPB 3, 62,500 killed. RPB 41, 36,800 killed, 18,500 deported. RPB 131, 14,900 killed, 35,500 deported. PB 304, 44,300 killed. PB 303, 41,600 killed. Given that RPB 61 and 53 were involved in the massive deportations from the Warsaw Ghetto, and RPB 9 and 3 were attached to the Einsatzgruppen, the killing record attained by RPB 101 stands out even more and exceeds any of the elite 300-level battalions composed of carefully selected, highly Nazified, intensively trained and indoctrinated young men. In short, part of the significance of RPB 101 as an illuminating case study is not that it was a typical or representative police battalion, but precisely the contrary. It was atypical in terms of age, selectivity, Nazification, training, and indoctrination, but nevertheless obtained the fourth highest killing record among all police battalions. Motivation. If many of the publications concerning the police battalions sought first to document their involvement in the Holocaust, and second to expose the utter inadequacy of post-war judicial reckoning, another cluster of publications has focused on the ongoing debate over motivation. How can a historian best explain why the order policemen behaved as they did? If the policemen were not coerced to act against their will, why did they choose to kill? In what ways did their actions make sense to them as unpleasant but necessary on the one hand, or justified and even praiseworthy on the other? In Ordinary Men, I cited the classic works of Stanley Milgram concerning obedience or deference to authority, and Philip Zimbardo concerning role adaptation. Additionally, I placed considerable emphasis on conformity as a key factor in trying to make sense of the behavior of the men of RPB 101 and explaining the group dynamics of the battalion. And I should have cited the work of Solomon Ash as well. This invoking of social psychology was deemed by Daniel Goldhagen to be of marginal significance on the one hand, and exculpatory of the policeman's moral responsibility on the other. In the aftermath of that debate, several social psychologists have made contributions that I have found particularly important in advancing our ability to explain the behavior of genocidal killers. In Becoming Evil, How Ordinary People Commit Genocide and Mass Killing, James Waller sought to explain how ordinary people committed extraordinary evil through a four-pronged model. First are innate and universal aspects of human nature that have emerged through the evolutionary process, designated by Waller as ethnocentrism, xenophobia, and desire of social dominance. Second are the factors that shape the dispositions of the perpetrators: cultural belief systems, moral disengagement, and rational self-interest. Third are factors that create an immediate social context: professional socialization, group binding, and merger of role and person. And fourth are factors that shape how perpetrators define or perceive their victims: us-them thinking, dehumanization, and blaming the victim. Clearly, this is a broad and universalistic approach, but one that allows also for historical specificity. It is a comprehensive rejection of any monocausal approach that would place undue explanatory weight on a single aspect of either a perpetrator nation's cultural belief system, such as anti-Semitism on the one hand, or of social context, such as conformity in group binding on the other. And it is a model that considers cultural and situational factors as complementary and mutually reinforcing, rather than as dichotomous or mutually exclusive explanations for human behavior. The second key contribution by a social psychologist was, in my opinion, made by Leonard S. Newman. He specifically addressed Goldhagen's dismissive treatment of social psychology, but at the same time, he articulated that discipline's wider contributions to explaining perpetrator behavior. Like Waller, Newman rejected the false dichotomy of cognitive versus situational or dispositional versus contextual explanations. Goldhagen's cognitive explanation was simply an assertion of attitude-behavior consistency, which accounts for some, but certainly not all, human behavior, and cannot be the sufficient explanation for something as complex as the actions of Holocaust perpetrators. There is, Newman notes, a dynamic relationship between persons/dispositions and situations. If attitude can shape behavior, The opposite is also the case. According to cognitive dissonance theory, discomfort occurs when people are engaged in activities that contradict their beliefs and attitudes, particularly when people are in a position that makes it difficult to alter their behavior. They tend to reduce the discrepancy between action and belief by altering the latter through devising justifications and rationalizations for what they are doing. People are more susceptible to this when in a position of induced compliance through subtle pressures like conformity and comradeship rather than outright coercion. Particularly when the behavior in question involves harming others, the harm-doer is likely to perceive the victim as deserving of punishment, a psychological response known as the just world phenomenon. This process, in turn, creates a vicious circle in the form of an escalation in cruelty and brutality, in harm-doing and dehumanization/devaluation of the victim. Through fundamental attribution error, people tend to ignore the impact of their own actions on others and attribute the degraded and miserable status of the victim as further proof of the victim's inherent inferiority or even subhumanity. In addition to the fact that behavior can change attitude, another aspect of the dynamic relationship between disposition and situation is that situations themselves are not static or objective, but rather subjective, because they are perceived, construed, and interpreted by the people in them. In particular, Newman notes that through a phenomenon he calls pluralistic ignorance, numerous individuals could conform to an illusory norm that almost everyone else in the battalion endorsed the killing of Jews, even if most individuals would never have harmed Jews acting on their own. The collective behavior of a group is not simply the sum of its individual dispositions, but is shaped by how group members perceive the group as a whole, as well as one another, and the situation they collectively find themselves in. The issues of how policemen perceived the institutional norms of the order police and the situations in which they found themselves as occupiers and enforcers of Nazi racial policy in Eastern Europe have been taken up by two scholars in particular, Edward Westermann and Jürgen Matthaus. They have examined the organizational culture and indoctrination practices of the order police. According to Westermann, organizational culture sets the boundaries for accepted behavior, establishes institutional goals, and defines the standards of group membership. With the centralization of all German police under Himmler in 1936, he and Order Police Chief Kurt DeLuge sought to establish both an institutional merger of the Order Police with the SS, as well as the transformation of its organizational culture through the dual processes of militarization and Nazification. Central to Nazification were the establishment of anti-Semitism and anti-Bolshevism as institutional norms, while militarization created an ethos of duty, comradeship, and absolute obedience. Together, they transformed policemen into ideological warriors through broadening the boundaries of acceptable and desired behavior and making mass murder of ideological enemies both acceptable and desirable. In short, while Goldhagen attributed the creation of willing executioners to centuries of the systemic inculcation of eliminationist anti-Semitism inherent in German culture, Westermann saw these ideological warriors as the calculated short-term product of the institutional culture of a Nazified and militarized German police. Jürgen Matthaus also argued that indoctrination of the order police has been insufficiently examined and too quickly dismissed as a factor in explaining police behavior. However, after actually examining the indoctrination materials used, he ultimately comes to a more complex conclusion about their effects than the basic attitude-behavior consistency model of Westermann, in which ideological warriors acted out institutionally implanted ideological beliefs. Matthaus notes that there already existed an ideological affinity between the police and the new regime in 1933, and the police generally refused to provide German Jews with protection against the various assaults they faced from party activists. Following the centralization of the German police in 1936, The order police were schooled with indoctrination materials prepared within the SS that portrayed the Jews as the most dangerous enemy of the German people, and attributed to this fine-built image of the enemy responsibility for liberalism, Marxism-Bolshevism, exploitive capitalism, Freemasonry, pacifism, and the politicized churches. The cool objectivity of racial principles, not emotion, dictated Nazi Jewish policy as a matter of self-defense. By late 1938 and early 1939, SS publications pointed to a total solution of the Jewish question through either Umsiedlung or Vernichtung, resettlement or annihilation. By December 1941, one such publication predicted a Europe free of Jews by the end of the war. At the same time, other training materials sought to maintain the police self-image of correctness, professionalism, incorruptibility, idealism, and decency. Matthaus argues that a direct causal relationship between indoctrination and participation in mass killing is difficult for the historian to prove in all but a few notorious cases, such as the initial atrocities committed by Police Battalion 309 in Bialystok. But he does think indoctrination facilitated the policemen's participation in many ways. It lowered inhibitions and provided legitimization for those seeking to rationalize or justify the brutal mass killing, as it portrayed their actions as a difficult duty and a historic mission that objective racial principles showed to be necessary self-defense. For those for whom this was not sufficient, it linked killing Jews with other legitimate missions, such as waging anti-partisan warfare or defeating communism, and it provided a facade or cover for other motives, greed, sadism, the opportunity to torture and kill with impunity that they wanted to hide from themselves. In short, these indoctrination materials provided a buffet of anti-Semitic slogans and assertions from which policemen could choose to help them mitigate and counter the cognitive dissonance that many experience with the onset of mass killing. In a seminal article on the order police as the foot soldiers of the final solution in the East, Klaus Michael Malmann also argued for a close relationship between the situation in which the policemen found themselves on Soviet territory and the enactment of Nazi racial ideology. Order police indoctrination, according to Malmann, has been overvalued. Its impact was seen less in the production of ideological fanaticism, or what he terms ideological fundamentalism, than in a more diffuse change in the mentality and attitude of the men through a denigration of Christian values as humanitarian drivel and traditional notions of soldierly chivalry as weak and unmanly. It encouraged policemen to think in racial categories of master race and subhumans, of German superiority and native inferiority, which could encompass a spectrum of anti-Jewish attitudes from aversion and contempt to hate and the desire to destroy, but facilitated the policeman's mass killing of non-Jewish victims in the East as well. Malmann also emphasized the group dynamics which shaped the policemen's lives, notions of manliness based on toughness and an overriding fear of being perceived as weak or cowardly, were part of their shared mental world, the origins of which predated National Socialism. As members of a unit or primary group that constituted their social world, they feared isolation and craved comradeship and community, the price of which was conformity to brutality, or more specifically, shooting alongside the others. Moral unburdening was found in collective identity. For Malmann, only a complex combination of cognitive and situational factors, complementary and mutually reinforcing, can explain the policemen's behavior as Holocaust perpetrators. But ultimately, like Matthaus, he concluded that the ideological factor was not the original driving force, but rather a subsequent sedative, not the actual impulse, but rather a narcotic after the fact. If Westermann looked at the organizational culture of the order police and its presumed impact on police behavior, and Matthaus and Malmann focused on how anti-Semitic ideology functioned within the situational context of Operation Barbarossa, Harold Welzer and Thomas Kuhne sought to articulate broader societal-wide frameworks that enabled or caused the policemen to value and embrace what they were doing. They, in effect, argued that Goldhagen posed the right question, but provided the wrong answer concerning why, for Germans, participation as a society, and not just order police units, subject to indoctrination and particular situational factors, in the final solution made sense. Harold Welzer, combining a case study of Reserve Police Battalion 45 with social psychological theorizing and historical background, posed two big questions. How and why did the normative frames of reference in Germany change so quickly and totally after 1933? And why were almost all ordinary men in units like RPB 45 willing to kill, even if they did so with varying degrees of enthusiasm, indifference, or distaste? For Welzer, the centerpiece of the Nazi Revolution was the redefining of the community of human obligation, from one of inclusion based on Enlightenment notions of humanity to one of exclusion based on racism and anti-Semitism. This radical restructuring of membership in the German community was possible in part because the exclusion and denigration of Jews inherently provided the psychic gratification of enhanced status, as well as opportunities for material gain for all included in the Volksgemeinschaft, racial community, even for those from the lowest rungs of the social ladder. For Welzer, 1933, not 1939 or 1941, was the key turning point for establishing these new social norms. The degree to which everyday social practice, beyond any conscious acceptance of Nazi ideology and propaganda, incorporated exclusion of the Jews from the community of human obligation meant broad acceptance of a new Nazi morality. The key elements of this Nazi morality were that it was good and meaningful to solve the Jewish question even through radical means, that work in that direction was difficult but rewarding, and that the ultimate goal was the creation of a community without Jews. However unimagined at the beginning, in the end, this exclusion allowed ordinary Germans to decouple the dispossession and murder of Jews on the one hand from any sense of criminality or immorality on the other. Welzer then examined how ordinary men in Reserve Police Battalion 45 became willing killers. Like Goldhagen, Welzer argued that the perpetrators, when confronted with their killing task, did not have to overcome moral scruples or inhibitions because they had already internalized the new frame of reference that decoupled the killing of Jews from criminality. Their killing actions were essentially a reflection of the beliefs they had adopted in previous years, but they still had to become acclimatized to what they were doing. Here he invoked both situation and process. These men, when confronted with the task of the mass murder of Jews, passed through a professionalizing and normalizing process that transformed mass murder into work. Many of them considered their work unpleasant, but nonetheless a necessary historic task about which they did not feel guilt either then or later. Thomas Kuhne argued for a synthesis of anthropological, social, and ideological factors in explaining the widespread participation of rank-and-file German soldiers and policemen in the Holocaust. He did not deny that anti-Semitism, anti-Bolshevism, and anti-Slavism were factors, but he considered them an insufficient explanation. Crucial to understanding the behavior of the ordinary Germans in uniform, he argued, were the myths of Kameradschaft and Volksgemeinschaft, comradeship and community. These powerful myths must be understood as the Germans knew them, for they were the lenses through which Germans saw the world, constructed their reality, and derived the moral framework that in turn shaped their behavior. The myth of the Volksgemeinschaft derived from Germany's euphoric sense and collective memory of unity transcending class, party, and confession, as proclaimed by the Kaiser in August 1914. With Germans traumatized by the defeat of 1918 and the Great Depression, the Nazis were able to appropriate the emotive power of the myth while transforming its essence from political, social, and religious inclusivity to racial exclusivity. Not only were Jews and other racial aliens excluded, but so were those whose behavior constituted an internal threat or potential treason against the German race. In short, conformity was an essential component of belonging. And the Nazis also appropriated the myth of Kameradschaft, based on the ideal of German national unity in the trenches, not the international brotherhood of all soldiers victimized by the war, as articulated by E.M. Remarque in All Quiet on the Western Front. The emotional power and need for belonging embodied in these two myths enabled the Nazis to preside over a moral revolution in which the Western tradition of universalism, humanity, and individual responsibility based on a guilt culture was replaced by a shame culture that elevated loyalty to and standing within the group to be the new moral fulcrum of German society. Whether it be the Volksgemeinschaft as a whole or the small unit within which a German fought, the group claimed moral sovereignty. The shame culture, making conformity a prime virtue, impelled ordinary Germans in uniform to commit terrible crimes rather than suffer the stigma of cowardice and weakness and the social death of isolation and alienation vis-à-vis their comrades. This dynamic was intensified by several other factors. The first was that the pleasures of comradeship and the joy of togetherness derived from a heightened sense of belonging could be enhanced even further through transgression against the norms of members outside the group. "Nothing makes people stick together better than committing a crime together," Kerner noted. And second was the pernicious Nazi invention that Kerner dubbed the morality of immorality. Both Hitler and various military commanders made the coercive zero-sum moral argument that pity and lenience toward the enemy and failure to overcome one's personal scruples was a sin against one's comrades and future generations. The combination of all these factors created a competition for mercilessness and a culture of brutality within units. For Germans at large, the outcome was the National Brotherhood of Mass Murder, Hitler's community. Kerner qualifies this grim portrayal of uniformity, conformity, and criminality in an important way. "Ethics do not change within just a couple of years for everyone," he noted. "Thus, uncertainty and dissenting convictions seethed in the culture of cruelty, and pangs of conscience persisted." Kerner cited the testimony of a member of the security police and SD in Warsaw concerning the spectrum and distribution of attitudes and participation among the perpetrators. "Absolute executioners about 30%, the anti-group about 20%, and then a group between, which stuck to the methods of the Hellraisers." Because two different value systems continued to coexist alongside one another, some Germans in uniform felt doubt, shame, and embarrassment. Many, nonetheless, joined in the mass killing and masked their feelings to avoid conspicuous nonconformity. Others who did not take part accepted the stigma of weakness and unmanliness, thereby validating the ethic of toughness of their comrades. Virtually no one dared show solidarity with the victims, reproach their comrades, or criticize the regime, though one could complain about the dirty business that the unit had been assigned. Though differing in some ways, virtually all of these scholars agree that any attempt to explain the motivation of the killers must be complex and multifaceted, not monocausal. They combine and synthesize situational and dispositional with cultural and ideological factors, rather than oppose them in a false dichotomy. In much the same way as the artificially polarized intentionalist-functionalist debate led to fruitful scholarship and various forms of a consensus model concerning Nazi decision and policy-making, so too the stark polarization of positions in the so-called Goldhagen debate has been superseded by more complex attempts at synthesis. The Luxemburgers. On April 8, 1996, Daniel Goldhagen presented his book Hitler's Willing Executioners to a symposium held at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, USHMM, and I was one of four respondents. In my comments, I noted that the presence of 14 Luxembourg policemen in Reserve Police Battalion 101, young men in their early 20s who had been incorporated into the German police after the annexation of Luxembourg to the Third Reich, offered the opportunity to measure the impact of similar situational factors on men of differing cultural and national background. Unfortunately, only one German witness described the participation of the Luxembourgers in the battalion's activities in any detail. As members of Lieutenant Buchmann's first company, they were present at Josefov, but escorted the Jews taken to Lublin for labor. While present for Trapp's speech, the roundup of the Jews, and the process of selection, they did not act as shooters on that occasion. Thereafter, according to this witness, the Luxembourgers were not only not exempt, but were intentionally chosen for assignments because of their youth and professional training. In general, the old men remained behind, but the Luxembourgers were in fact present at every action. With these people, it was a matter of career police officials from the state of Luxembourg, who were all young men in their 20s. The Luxembourg historian Paul Dostert called to my attention the post-war accounts of two of these 14 Luxembourg members of RPB 101, which had been published in 1986. Several aspects of their accounts stand out. First, they portrayed themselves as victims of both German conscription and the horrors of war. Second, they portrayed the actions of the Luxembourgers as consistently non-supportive of the German cause. Roger Vietor claimed to have provided the Polish resistance with both information about impending searches and arrests, as well as guns and ammunition, at great risk to himself. Jean Heinen claimed that the Luxembourgers assigned to machine gun duty did not shoot in action and feigned stoppages. Beginning in June 1944, five Luxembourgers successfully deserted, and two others were killed trying to go over to the Russians. Crucially, neither account mentioned even the presence of Jews, much less the battalion's participation in their mass murder. Faced with these two accounts, I suggested two arguments from silence, i.e., drawing inferences from what was not said. First, Vietor and Heinen had detailed various aspects of dissident behavior to portray themselves as victims, not collaborators of the Germans. If they had been among the non-shooters, would they not have claimed this to their credit in post-war accounts as well? If many German witnesses could remember the non-shooters in the battalion 20 years later, but made no comment about the Luxembourgers in this regard, was it because they had behaved like most of their German comrades in 1942? Arguments from silence are suggestive, not definitive. They constitute circumstantial evidence concerning probability, not proof. Thus, the role of the Luxembourgers in RPB 101 remained intriguing but unresolved. When my comments about the Luxembourgers in RPB 101 were published in Germany in 1998, they received coverage in several Luxembourg newspapers. This, in turn, led to a vigorous response from Jean Heinen in the Luxembourger Wort. He admitted that 1st Company of RPB 101 had shot Jews, but he had not seen whether a Luxembourger had shot. He had not made any mention of his unit's involvement in killing Jews because he was no historian and because he concerned himself with the fate of the Luxembourg group and not the unfortunate fate of the Jews. Heinen admitted that he had been involved in two deportation actions, escorting Jews from the ghetto to the train station, but he made no mention of the routine brutality and shooting that accompanied such ghetto-clearing actions. On one occasion, he accompanied the train to where he did not know, but the destination could have been Treblinka. As 1st Company was involved in 6 deportations to Treblinka and 2 large relocations from Radzin to Mędrzyciec and from Kotsk to Wukow, it seems likely that Heinen was involved in more than 2 deportation actions. Heinen admitted that he was present at 2 mass shootings in November 1943, and his descriptions of the Erntefest massacre at Majdanek and Poniatowa coincide with other testimony. He admitted that on the second day he left his cordon post briefly to observe firsthand the shooting at the mass grave and the piles of corpses. "The horror that I saw there I cannot describe, because the appropriate words fail me," he wrote. But he denied being present at any other shooting actions, though 1st Company carried out shootings at Serekomla, Talsin and Kotsk, and Wukuf. He admitted involvement in a Parchev forest sweep in late 1942 in which hundreds of Jews who had fled the ghettos were killed, but claimed it and other patrols were only anti-partisan actions, not Jew hunts. In short, like many German witnesses, Heinen admitted to some involvement by his unit in killing Jews, but denied any personal involvement in killing by himself or his Luxembourg comrades on the one hand, and most likely minimized and sanitized the extent of his unit's involvement on the other. His letter to the editor admitted far more than either he or any other Luxembourger had done previously, but nonetheless he asserted that I had made a fool of myself in suggesting that there had previously been any conspiracy of silence. What has subsequent research added to our knowledge of the Luxembourgers in RPB 101 and their previous silence? Paul Dostert discovered that following the verdict in the Hamburg trial of Olaf, Hoffmann, and others, the investigation of several other members of the battalion continued, including Sergeant Hans Keller of 1st Company. In a lengthy interrogation in July 1964, he denied any memory of events before August 1942, such as Josefov, but admitted that his unit took part in the ghetto clearings of Parchev and Mionjitsits, and that many hundreds of Jews had been shot in the course of the latter. He was stationed for cordon duty during the Serekomla and Talsin Kotsk killings and described the former in great detail. He admitted that the first two sweeps of the Parchev forest in late 1942 were aimed at escaped Jews, and only in the spring of 1943 did patrols there target non-Jewish partisans. He participated in three other Jew hunts, operating under an explicit shooting order for all Jews discovered. Subsequently, he denied everything he had admitted. In February 1973, Keller traveled to Luxembourg and prevailed upon three former Luxembourgers in his unit to sign a statement that he had carefully drafted to exonerate himself, and thereby also the Luxembourgers in his unit, of participating in atrocities in Poland. During the first weeks in Poland, they were guarding a sawmill and knew nothing of Józefów. Again sent on distant guard duty, they heard of a great deportation action, possibly Parchev, and likewise were not present at Talsin or Serekomla because they had been sent on patrol. They knew of no deportations from Kotsk, though they were stationed there. The Parchev sweep was a fruitless search for partisans. Interviewed by German judicial authorities the following December, all three repeated their denials of having been involved in any shootings or deportation actions. Two admitted that they had been sent to Mianjizets, but had been detached to guard a leather factory producing for the Wehrmacht, where they helped the Jewish manager to rescue his Jewish workers from the roundup, and in gratitude had been rewarded each with pieces of leather. As one Luxembourger testified, "We never had anything to do with Jews. We never rounded them up or took them from one place to another. We were only always underway with our bicycles in the fields and forests in search of partisans. During our patrols, we never encountered Jews." The German investigators re-interviewed five German witnesses from the same unit as the Luxembourgers. Their verdict was unanimous, that the Luxembourgers had never been exempted from any tasks, including anti-Jewish actions. More specially, one witness recalled that Keller had badgered him so relentlessly to change his testimony that finally he had refused to let him in the door. Another noted that one officer in the company was a special friend of the Luxembourgers, and for entertainment they would go into Kotsk after the nightly blackout and shoot out lights that were still on inside houses. And a third claimed that on platoon commander Brandt's order, a Luxembourger had shot a pregnant woman who had been caught sheltering Jews. If three men concerting together to give transparently false testimony, followed by failure of the written accounts of Vietor and Heinen to mention Jews at all, does not constitute a tacit conspiracy of silence among the Luxembourgers, then the term has no meaning whatsoever. Clearly, the Luxembourgers as a group were involved in the battalion's activities, including anti-Jewish actions, as Heinen later admitted, even if there is no evidence concerning any identifiable individual's personal complicity. Dostert's investigation into the historical background of the Luxembourgers' incorporation into the German police does indicate, however, that the path these men took to RPB 101 was so different from that of their German counterparts that it renders any comparison problematic. The Freiwillige Company, comprised of 455 men, was tiny Luxembourg's military force prior to its conquest by Nazi Germany in May 1940. Many more men applied to the Freiwillige Company than space allowed, because a 3-year term of service made them eligible for a subsequent career in the police. Thus, the acceptance of many suitable applicants was often deferred. In September 1940, Heinrich Himmler visited Luxembourg, inspected the Freiwillige Company, and decided that those deemed suitable should be incorporated into either the SS or German Order Police. A significant number of these Luxembourgers must have been excluded in the vetting process, which examined both racial background and political reliability, since many previously deferred applicants were now asked if they were still interested and invited to join. The personnel files of 11 of the 14 Luxembourgers in RPB 101 survived in the Hamburg Staatsarchiv, but one is incomplete. From the other 10, it can be seen that 5 were members of the Freiwillige Company before the German occupation, but the other 5 were deferred candidates invited to join in September 1940. In short, they were not transferred automatically or against their will into German service. They decided to join what they now knew to be an auxiliary police force of the German occupier, taking advantage of an employment opportunity that occupation created. Clearly, the attitudes and reactions of the Luxembourgers varied widely. While some actively chose to join in September 1940, attrition among the former members of the Freiwillige Company was high, as was the cost of refusing to serve. Of the original 455 members, Dostert calculates that 264 ended up in German prisons or concentration camps, where 48 died before the end of the war. From December 1940 to May 1941, the Luxembourgers then in the unit were taken to Germany for training and National Socialist indoctrination. Despite promises that they would return to serve in Luxembourg, only 55 were reassigned there. One group of 116, including the future RPB 101 contingent, was sent to Cologne and then to anti-partisan duty in Slovenia. Many requested release from police service but were refused. When this large unit of Luxembourgers proved unreliable in the anti-partisan war, however, they were withdrawn from Slovenia and dispersed in small groups to other German units. This is how 14 came to RPB 101 in June 1942. However, 44 refused either to accept reassignment or to take an additional oath to the Führer and were sent to concentration camps in Buchenwald, Sachsenhausen, Neuengamme, and Dachau. Of the 14 in RPB 101, 5 were killed in the last 2 years of the war. 3 deserted in 1944 by not returning from leave and going underground in Luxembourg, and 1 ended his service through a self-inflicted wound in January 1945. Like other populations occupied by Nazi Germany, different Luxembourgers made different choices at different times and paid different costs. But unlike the German rank and file in RPB 101, the 14 Luxembourgers were not random middle-aged conscripts called up to serve their country in the middle of the war. The photographic evidence, insights and limitations. When I was researching and writing Ordinary Men in the late 1980s and early 1990s, I asked several archives about relevant photographs. Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, YIVO in New York, and the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw all kindly made available the small number of photographs, sometimes duplicate copies, that they had, and these photos were included in the first edition with my brief captions, but no further comment or analysis. In part, this was because the archives themselves had provided so little information about these photographs. 25 years later, the situation has changed significantly in 3 ways. Photo archivists have researched their collections with greater care and corrected some of the erroneous captions they previously offered. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum Photo Archive has obtained a collection of private family albums, one compiled by a member of RPB 101 during its second tour of duty in Poland in 1940 to 1941, and photographs collected by the Hamburg prosecutors in the RPB 101 case authenticated according to legal standards of evidence, have now become available. As a result, a number of photos have been added for this edition, additional commentary has been provided for some of the earlier photos, and one major error has been corrected. Sadly, iconic photos are often the most carelessly used. A prime example is provided by the photograph I chose for the cover of Ordinary Men, from a sequence of three photographs held in multiple copies and vaguely identified by sight, namely Wukuf in Poland, in three different archives, the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw, Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, and YIVO in New York. Copies are now also in the photo archive of the USHMM, which had not yet opened at that time. The photos were undated, and none of the Germans were identified. According to YIVO, the first photo in the sequence was donated in the late 1940s by someone from the Bronx who claimed that the man standing center-left with the white beard was a family relative, Motl Hershberg of Wukuf. According to Yad Vashem, the kneeling Jew of the third photo was identified as Rabbi Isaac Verobel of Wukuf, and that this photo was found in Wukuf after the war and given to returning Jews. However, the photo archives in Yad Vashem also now notes that there is an equally valid rival claim that these photos are from Tarnow, and that it has insufficient evidence to determine the site of the photos either way. In the illustration section of Ordinary Men, two photos of this sequence were cautiously labeled Wukuf, probably in the fall of 1942. But the sequence of the three photos was not further analyzed, as ought to have been done. The photos were not used as evidence in the Hamburg court case against RPB 101. No one from the battalion was identified in the pictures. Let us examine the photos as a sequence. The first photo is especially interesting because, in addition to the men in greatcoats, there are two men clearly in Wehrmacht uniforms, far right and third from left. Several of the men are not yet looking at the camera or smiling, and one German seems to be pointing his hand as if he were holding a pistol at one of the kneeling Jews and feigning a mock execution. In the second photo, the two obvious Wehrmacht men have disappeared, and only the men in greatcoats remain in the picture. Clearly, the photographer has alerted the men that he is about to take the picture, since they are all looking directly at the camera and one is smiling. It is the obscenely wide grin on the face of the German on the left that riveted my attention and caused me to select this particular photo for the book cover. Whether this was a smile of schadenfreude, of expressing ghoulish pleasure at the humiliation of the Jews, or simply a reflex action of smiling at the camera, I do not know, though at the time of my selecting the photo for the cover, I incautiously assumed the former. The third photograph was taken as the staged scene was breaking up. Most of the Jews and several of the Germans are turning away. Only one Jew in his finery remains kneeling, and only one German is still looking at the cameraman. We do not know what happened between the second and third photos, other than that the kneeling Jew is no longer wearing his head cover, suggesting that he may have been physically roughed up. Six different copies of this photo were donated to Yad Vashem, and YIVO holds multiple copies as well. Most macabre, one of YIVO's copies is a postcard with a place for address, stamp, and writing on the back. Clearly, the third photo had iconic status and was in open circulation in Poland after the war. The rival claim of Tarnow is only one possible reason why no one in these photos was identified as an order policeman from RPB 101. Studying with enhanced technology the emblems on the berets of the men in greatcoats, previously assumed to be members of the order police, the archivists at Yad Vashem have now concluded that they were members of the Wehrmacht instead. In short, possibly by time, unspecified, place, Tarnow rather than Wukuf, and unit involved, Wehrmacht, not order police, these pictures have nothing to do with Reserve Police Battalion 101 at all. These photos illustrate what we already know, namely that the Germans in Poland often conducted rituals of humiliation and staged trophy photos of their exploits. But they do not provide evidence of individual participation, much less the worldview and anti-Semitic convictions of members of RPB 101. They also provide a salutary lesson on the careless and casual mistakes that frequently characterize the archival filing and historians' use of photographic evidence a quarter century ago. Let us now turn to the three photo albums acquired by the USHMM that were compiled by the Hamburg family of Bernhard Kohlberg, born in 1900 and a member of PB101 during its second tour of duty in Poland in 1940 to 1941. Family scenes dominate the first two albums, but many photos in the third album were taken by Bernhard during his tour of duty in Poland and suggest that he was an enthusiastic photographer. A few photos of the pre-1933 period show demonstration of the Reichsbanner, an SPD affiliate supportive of the Weimar Republic. By the mid-1930s, his son is in the Deutschen Jungvolk, the Hitler Youth level for 10 to 14-year-olds. This suggests that members of the Kohlberg family, like many other Germans, may well have made the transition from social democratic affiliation to accommodation with the Nazi regime. Kohlberg was sent to serve in PB101 in Poland from October 1, 1940 to April 7, 1941. In many posed photographs, he proudly displayed himself in uniform. On one occasion, only he recorded German repressive measures. In this case, one photo of a public hanging in progress with many spectators, followed by another of the bodies left hanging after all the spectators have departed, a not uncommon sight in Nazi-occupied Europe. He seemed fascinated with pictures of war-damaged buildings, which seemed incidentally to show, at a distance, Jewish workers involved in cleanup work. The few close-up pictures of Jews did not negatively portray them as the stereotypical Ostjuden of Nazi propaganda. One portrays a strong, handsome Jewish worker, another a Jewish family in repose by the roadside. Most interesting, perhaps, are Kohlberg's photos of the Łódź ghetto, where PB101 members served external guard duty. Rather than examples of ghetto tourism recording unattractive Jews living in filth and hunger that confirmed Nazi stereotypes, Kohlberg deliberately photographed a ghetto without Jews. He was interested in using the night lighting and ghetto fencing for photographic effect and composition, not in recording ghetto life. In one case where Jews appear in his photographs of ghetto fencing, it does seem to be the rare case of a staged scene in which uniformed Jewish ghetto police are kneeling in the snow across the fence from German police. Ironically, the last photo in the Kohlberg album is of himself once again in uniform, serving as a policeman in the post-war British occupation of northern Germany. The man who accommodated himself to the Nazis after 1933 did likewise for the Allied occupation after 1945. Let us turn now to the photographs from the photo collection, or Lichtbildmappe, in the prosecuting attorney's files for the trial of RPB-101 in Hamburg. Some of these photographs were provided by battalion members summoned for interrogation. Others were obtained from photo archives, particularly in Poland, and authenticated during interrogation. These photos can be divided into four categories. 1. Official headshots of the officers and non-commissioned officers. 2. Informal buddy pictures of groups of men from the battalion. 3. Informal snapshots recording various seemingly innocent, normal activities of the battalion. And 4. Snapshots, both single and in sequence, documenting aspects of the battalion's participation in its destructive mission against the Jews. Both typical and most important of the 32 official headshots are 3 senior officers of the battalion: Major Wilhelm Trapp, Captain Julius Wohlauf, and Lieutenant Hartwig Gnade. Among the various group buddy pictures, there is an extensive collection of 7 of Gruppe Beckemeyer from Lieutenant Gnade's 2nd Company stationed in Womazi in August 1942. Of the 2 examples here, the 2nd is rare in showing fraternization with the local population. 2 of the 4 men are holding 2 children, with a couple who are presumably the parents, one of whom is identified in another picture as the Polish cook for the unit, standing behind. This is on the site where the battalion either was going to carry out or had already carried out one of its most ferocious massacres of local Jews on August 18, 1942. The Lichtbildmappe does not identify the photographer of this Gruppe Beckemeyer sequence, though a number of the men in the pictures are identified. Among other group pictures is a more formally composed collective portrait of Major Trapp and his staff at Radzin. Of the normal activity pictures of the battalion, the single most striking one is an outdoor officers' dinner that includes the wives of Captain Volov and Lieutenant Brandt, Vera and Lucia. In the rear area of the Lublin district, wives of officers were able to visit their husbands. The presence of Vera Volov at the marketplace during the first massive and deadly ghetto clearing of Mrzyzets Podlaski, during which close to 1,000 Jews were killed on the spot and some 10,000 were dispatched to Treblinka on August 25th to 26th, 1942, disturbed many of the men. And Lucia Brandt provided one of the more revealing testimonies concerning the brutal mentality that had developed within the battalion by the time she visited her husband. Also among the normal activity photos are a sequence of four pictures, two shown here, of men assembled for an outdoor concert that is being given by musicians in uniform using the flat roof of a low building as their stage. The odd assortment of instruments, including two accordions, one bass, one violin, and one guitar, would suggest that this was a performance given by an improvised group of battalion members and not some more professional traveling entertainment unit. Neither date nor location is given. In yet another single photo, the battalion truck drivers are led in singing. For historical purposes, these photos attest to the attempt to create a certain normalcy for men who we know from other evidence were engaged in anything but normal behavior. In Himmler's extraordinary memorandum of December 12, 1941, the Reichsfuhrer SS himself explicitly recommended quiet evenings of cultural activity as a soothing antidote to the stresses of mass killing and the preferred alternative to heavy drinking. It was a sacred duty, heilige Pflicht of the officers, Himmler wrote, to ensure that none of those who had to fulfill this difficult task were ever brutalized or suffered damage to their soul and character. Die diese schwere Pflicht zu erfüllen haben, jemals verrockt oder an Gemüt und Charakter erleidet. For this purpose, comradely get-togethers, kameradschaftliches Beisammensein, were to be held on the evenings of such difficult tasks, which were never to involve alcohol abuse, but rather were to be devoted to music and presentations that would lead the men back to the beautiful realm of German spiritual and inner life. Die schönen Gebiete deutschen Geistes und Gemütslebens. These photos indicate that Himmler's exhortation was taken to heart and acted upon in RPB 101. That did not, of course, preclude the more normal forms of raucous evening entertainment that included the heavy use of alcohol, the Reichsfuhrer's wishes to the contrary notwithstanding. Such an evening is captured in the photo of members of 1st Platoon 3rd Company in Chmielniki. Of greatest interest for both prosecutors and historians are the photos of the battalion in action, carrying out its lethal task. The most striking set of photos in this regard are a sequence of five of the Womaze Aktion on August 18, 1942, in which 1,700 Jews were collected on the sports field in town, marched to the forest, and murdered in a mass grave. Of the five photos, the first two provide distant and close-up pictures of Jews sitting on the ground in the sports field. The third shows additional seated Jews assembled in a field partially shaded by trees. The fourth shows nine shirtless, strong men digging a large rectangular pit. The fifth shows 17 women, still fully clothed, being rushed forward toward the cameraman, with the capped face of a German policeman just visible behind the group. An armband with the Star of David is fully visible on the lead woman. The strained expressions on the women's faces indicate the frenetic pace of the forced march from the sports field to the killing pit. In all the photos, the focus is clearly on the victims and the Aktion, with the individual Germans included only incidentally and distantly in the first, third, and fifth photos. If the Womaze photos depict events leading up to the mass shooting, one single photo from Mrzyzets Podlaski, a collection ghetto that was repeatedly cleared and refilled, confirms the description of a mass shooting that took place there on October 6, 1942. On this day, thousands of Jews were deported to Treblinka. Despite their utmost efforts, the Germans could not cram all of the intended victims into the inadequate number of available train cars, and Lieutenant Gnade ordered the remaining 150 Jews, mostly women and children, to be taken to the nearby cemetery and shot by the cemetery wall. This photo, the only one in the entire collection that actually shows the bodies of murdered victims of the battalion, provides gruesome confirmation of an improvised execution in which no preparations had been made beforehand to either dig a mass grave or collect the clothing of the victims. Following the ghetto clearing operations in the northern Lublin district in the fall of 1942, members of RPB 101 engaged in repeated Jew hunts for escaped and hiding Jews. Once again, it is Lieutenant Gnade and men of the 2nd Company, for whom two photos have survived, that record them on patrol in the forest and fields outside Mianjizets. Following a long pause over the winter of 1942 to 1943, the ghetto of Mianjizets Podlaski was subjected to the 5th and 6th actions of May 1st and 26th, 1943. In the 6th action, some 1,000 Jews were sent to the concentration camp at Majdanek on the outskirts of Lublin rather than to Treblinka. By this time, Gnade had constructed an undressing barracks outside the city, where the deportees were deprived of their valuables and most of their clothing before being loaded into the waiting train cars. Numerous photos capture four distinct stages of the deportation action from Mianjizets: collection on the town square, the march from town, the strip search at Gnade's undressing barrack, and loading the train. Two sequences, whether from one or two different photographers is uncertain, can be dated to the 6th action of May 26th. They were not recovered from the private possession of members of the battalion, but rather sent to the prosecution by the Jewish Historical Institute in Poland and verified during subsequent interrogations. Some of the other photos may also date to this action, but some of them also appear to have been taken at an entirely different time. A single sequence of four photographs was taken on the town square in Mianjizets as the Jews are collected and marched off on May 26, 1943. An additional photograph, seemingly taken with long shadows early in the morning, shows heavily clothed Jewish women sitting in the town square without any Germans in the picture and may well date to the previous fall. Four additional photographs document the march out of town. Two seem to be taken by the same photographer. A third, in which the Germans are dressed in a similar manner, was probably taken on the same day. In a fourth, showing some Jews being taken out of town on peasant wagons, the sole German guard is dressed in heavier clothing, suggesting a deportation action the previous fall. An extensive set of six photographs captures scenes at Gnade's undressing barracks. It seems very likely that all six were taken by the same photographer at the same time, namely during one of the May 1943 actions. Five of these photos portray the most direct and intimate interaction between German policemen and their Jewish victims. Clearly, the photographer's focus is on Jewish women, not men, including 1. One of a fully clothed woman facing three Germans in front of the barracks. 2. Two of a woman clad only in white undergarments that she holds to her body while talking directly to German officers, identified as Gnade and a Bavarian gendarmerie officer. And 3. One of a solitary, short, and somewhat hunchbacked Jewish woman surrounded by German policemen, Gnade in profile, the Bavarian facing the camera, who tower above her to the side of the barracks. The photographer seemed to have no interest at all in taking pictures of Jewish men. The final stage of the deportation process was the loading of the train cars. There are three surviving photographs that were not included in the prosecutor's collection for the Hamburg trial of RPB 101, but which were sent to the USHMM from the Main Commission for the Investigation of Nazi Crimes in Poland at a later date. The archival caption at the USHMM states that it is likely that these are photos of the 6th action in Mianjizets Podlaski on May 26, 1943. I find this dating quite dubious. The Jews are mostly women and some children, while the other photos show many men and no children at this late date. And the Jews are wearing far heavier clothing than seems likely for a late May deportation following a strip search at Gnade's undressing barracks. Moreover, none of these photos was used in evidence at the Hamburg trial, which suggests that none of the German personnel was identified as definitely from RPB-101. The lack of framing of these pictures, the shaky focus of the first, and the fact that no one is looking at the photographer suggests the possibility that this series of three was most likely taken surreptitiously, perhaps by a Polish railway worker or some other non-German observer. As with the Wukuf photos, therefore, we are left with photographs for which the precise time, place, and circumstances of the events depicted, to say nothing of the identity of the photographer, are difficult to corroborate. The last major killing action in which RPB-101 was involved was the great Erntefest massacre of the Lublin labor camps in November 1943. RPB-101 participated in the liquidation of the Jewish prisoners of Majdanek on November 3rd and of Poniatowa on November 4th. There is a sequence of 10 photos from Poniatowa that shows no Germans and no killing, but once again ominously documents the preparatory stages. They show in succession the factory where the Jews worked, Jews standing outside wooden barracks where they were lodged, a column of Jews carrying their bundles and marching down a road with high fences on each side, and a watchtower in the background. And finally, Jews sitting and standing in an open compound surrounded by a high wire fence and overlooked by a watchtower. The sequence seems to have been taken by someone who was free to move about and openly photograph the people whom he was guarding. The Jews are in civilian clothing, not concentration camp garb, since Poniatowa was a forced labor camp. Zwangsarbeitslager, not an official concentration camp, Konzentrationslager. And only the last three photos, with wire and watchtower, make clear that the photos were taken inside a camp. The sequence tells an ominous story only because we know the context and outcome from other sources. Dan Porat argues that in order to understand a historical event as presented in a photograph, narration is essential. One very possible benefit of photos collected for judicial proceedings is that they join together the photographic image, the narrative historical background, and verification of specifics by witnesses. Concerning historical photographs, Judith Levin and Daniel Uziel have suggested that in addition to the time and place they were taken, it is desirable to know the photographer, the people in the photograph, the provenance of the photograph, and whether it is a single shot or part of a collection or album. Few photographs from the Holocaust are so amply documented, but at least in this collection, some of these questions can be answered some of the time. In the judicial process, history illuminates the photos, and the photos illuminate history in a reciprocal and reinforcing manner. Historians almost invariably work with imperfect and problematic evidence, and photographic evidence is no exception. Levin and Uziel also write, "We would expect a German photographer imbued with Nazi ideology to focus his lens differently than an ordinary German would. But even concerning ordinary Germans taking pictures in the occupied East, Levin and Uziel assumed as a point of departure that the anti-Semitic climate and propaganda had an immense impact on the entire population, and hence that the shutters were pressed by people whose ideological consciousness manifested itself in the photographs they took or collected. Taken as a whole, do the photographs in the Kohlberg album and this judicial collection broadly reflect the impact of a pervasive anti-Semitic climate and even an unconscious Nazi ideological framing on the part of the perpetrators? Unquestionably, there are numerous photographs, especially ones like the staged ritual humiliation at Wukuf or Tarnow, with which we began the discussion in this section, that reflect the anti-Semitic attitudes and sense of racial superiority of those having themselves photographed. But such staged photographs explicitly reflecting a Nazi outlook are not found in the collection of photos that can be clearly identified as pertaining to RPB-101. Indeed, it is possible that some of these photographs were taken by Poles as evidence of Nazi crimes in Poland, not by Germans as trophies of Nazi accomplishments. I suspect that the photo of the dead Jewish women by the cemetery wall in Mianjiewicz, with no Germans visible in the picture, was taken after the German killers had departed. I suspect the loading of the train at Mianjiewicz was also taken surreptitiously by a Polish photographer. And some of the other photos reflect a seeming normalcy of military life that we know not to be normal only because of additional knowledge that we as viewers bring to our viewing of them. But what of the Womazi and Mianjizhets photos? In the remarkable Womazi sequence, the Jewish victims, not the German killers, are at the center. These are quick snapshots, not staged scenes, and the one caption simply identifies the subjects factually as condemned Jews, but without further derogatory comment. The assembly of Jews on the Mianjizhets town square and the march out of town shows many Germans, but again, these photos are quick snapshots that record the scene. They are neither staged nor captioned, nor are they particularly triumphalist, celebratory, or ideological in their framing. The ease with which the photographer could move about and take these pictures seems to indicate he was a German. These photos portray men not in staged celebration, but simply at work. It is the matter-of-factness of the photographer's recorded preparations for the mass shooting at Womazi and the deportation from Mianjizhets that is perhaps most disturbing. The sequence taken at Gnade's undressing barracks again is stunning in that several of them capture groups of German officers and individual Jewish women in unusual proximity and interaction. The photos certainly capture the asymmetry of power between Germans and Jews. There is also a clear gendered dimension, with individual small Jewish women being confronted by groups of big, bullying men. These photos are very revealing of how the Germans treated the Jewish women of Mianjizhets. That someone took these photos to preserve a suitable record of the battalion's activities demonstrates a severely stunted sensibility. One of the controversies surrounding RPB 101 has been whether the eager, ideologically driven anti-Semitic killers within the battalion constituted a zealous minority or the vast majority of its members. And Levin and Uziel have argued that the photographs, even of ordinary Germans, would reflect the pervasive anti-Semitism and propaganda of the regime. We do not know, of course, how many highly incriminating photos were taken that have been kept secret or were destroyed. But what does this collection of recovered photos of the battalion indicate? The photos of the Kohlberg album from 1940 to 1941 are remarkable for their general lack of reflecting a Nazified outlook. The pictures that record the destructive work of the battalion on its third tour of duty in Poland seem devoid of the explicit ideological or propagandistic framing that can be seen in the staged and celebratory Wehrmacht photos from Wukow. But they do reflect a moral numbness, a routinization of destruction as everyday work that speaks less to the motivation of the policemen than to the impact of their actions on themselves. This concludes the reading of Ordinary Men, Reserve Police Battalion 101 and the Final Solution in Poland by Christopher R. Browning. Copyright 1992 and 1998 by Christopher Browning. This book was read by Stefan Rudnicki and directed by Claire Bloom. This unabridged recording was produced by arrangement with HarperCollins Publishers and was produced in 2017 by Blackstone Audio Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.